Hey there, my name's Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And this episode, I am stoked to be chatting with two eagle-eyed MVPs to cast a canny look at the intersection of politics and music. So welcome to the podcast, Edgar D. Gankendorf, aka Dino, co-managing partner at Provost and Gankendorf LLC. How are you doing, Dino?
I'm doing well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And you're joining us from where in the beautiful US of A at the moment?
Yes, downtown New Orleans.
Oh, man, that's a downtown I'm very, very fond of. Brilliant stuff. Thank you. And joining Dino on the podcast, we have Richard Kirstein, who is the author of Music Rights Without Fights and a music rights specialist. How are you doing, Richard?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Awesome. And where are you joining us from today?
I'm on the lovely south coast of England in Worthing.
Oh my goodness, Worthing is a beautiful place. Very, very fond of it. That's fantastic. So listen, before we dive right in, we're going to look at this intersection of politics and music. Obviously, it's something of a hot potato at the moment, particularly given the US election that's just passed and all of the issues around rights clearance and artists affiliating themselves with political candidates, etc. So it's really, really a kind of hot topic. But before we dive into that, I'd love for our listeners to get to know a little bit about your background. So I have taken the liberty of looking at the internet and getting a few key facts about you. So Dino, your CV is spectacular. You have been voted the best music attorney by Offbeat magazine 6 times. You have been a commissioner for the Louisiana Music Commission for many, many years. You are a lecturer at the Music Business Institute, the Cutting Edge Music Conference, Tulane University, Loyola University, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And your music clients include some of my favorite artists of all time, folks like Mavis Staples, Trombone Shorty, Juvenile, Lake Street Dive, Samantha Fish. Absolutely brilliant to have you here, Dino. And Richard, you have an equally stellar CV, which I'd love to just fly through before we dive into the big issues. Now, you are a founding partner at Brazilian Music LLP. You've been brokering music licenses for brands in luxury fashion, gaming, financial services, and alcoholic beverages sectors. You're also the head of rights at Imprint Records Limited, which is a startup covers catalog business. You are a music rights management consultant at Advertising Production Resources, or APR, advising clients on the best practice for music licensing across alcoholic beverages, beauty, financial services, and confectionery sectors, all the fun sectors right there. You're an ex-MD and founder at Leap Music and the former head of film, TV, and media at Zomba Music Publishers Limited. So my goodness, I'd be hard pressed to find two more impressive CVs and more suitable CVs to talk about this very pertinent issue. So thank you both so much for joining us. Let's dive right in. So first big question, why is music so powerful and persuasive when combined with politics? What say you, Richard?
Well, I think like any brand, music aids audience engagement. I mean, it creates cut through. It's a shortcut to emotions and memories, and it borrows equity from third party content. And politicians want to tap into all of that. They want to engage their audiences. They want to fire them up, especially at rallies. And music is a great tool for doing that.
Indeed. What's your take on this, Dino?
Yeah, I would say I'd probably bring up 4 points, which is, one, music energizes people, right? They're familiar with music. They get an enthusiastic response. And obviously, merging that into a political message might excite people. The lyrical content could be supportive of a political message. You know, something like in the US, FDR back in the day used a song, Happy Days Are Here Again. So that was a song during the Depression, and that was his message to the voters. The third one I would think of is a little tricky now, and I think we'll talk a lot about this, but it's something of an implied endorsement by the writer of the music or the performer of the music. So, you know, is there some linkage between Springsteen doing a song and the politician using that in a commercial? And then the final thought would be, does it suggest something about the politician's identity, his positions, kind of his overall coolness or his cultural literacy? So, you know, I think maybe we could look back at someone like Obama using Stevie Wonder, Signed, Sealed, and Delivered, and people think, oh, that's pretty hip. So yeah, I think that those kind of points to me are why a politician might find music a persuasive tool and powerful.
Yeah, yeah, great points. And speaking of Obama, I do enjoy his playlists very much. I don't know how often he puts them out these days, but every time I'm impressed by the breadth and the high taste that he brings to the table. So nice reference there. But Richard, talk to us a bit about your book, Music Rights Without Fights, because there's been a lot of fighting around music clearance for political use. Why do you think it's so contentious?
Well, firstly, the book was written for brand marketers, so that the focus of what I do is clearing music for marketing communications, you know, primarily TV commercials or online video content.
Right.
And in that context, writers and artists almost always have the right of approval. So whilst I might be sending requests through to music publishers and record labels on behalf of our brand clients, wherever there is sort of, in inverted commas, a brand in the room, it is very normal for the artist and the songwriter to have a right of approval for video content where the brand can choose which music is synced to that those moving images before they are broadcast. Now, in the political arena, exactly the same rules apply for campaign videos that are prepared and subsequently released. However, the reason this area is so contentious is that for live rallies, the only license that is required is a public performance license for the actual venue. And this is where so many of the stories that we read about Trump become very relevant, because he will use music in a venue at a political rally. He won't be the party filming it. It will be news organizations filming it and broadcasting it. And Trump's team will say, the venue has a public performance license. That's all we need. We don't need individual permission. And this speaks to the heart of the contentious issue about why writers and artists get so exercised when politicians that they do not like use their music at events which are subsequently broadcast by media organizations, but not the politician themselves.
Fascinating, fascinating. Okay, I wonder what the writers of Ave Maria would say. I think he's been rather fond of using that in some of the rallies. But Dino, coming over to yourself, have you kind of come across any examples of, you know, as we've heard there, Richard is saying there is a kind of implicit music right for music to be played back in public at a venue, etc. And this has been used to maybe get around some objections from musicians. Do musicians kind of have a point? Can they say, don't use my music at the rallies? Or is this really just a fait accompli?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different situations here. I mean, one is we're seeing examples where politicians are playing a video at a rally. Or we can go back to like John McCain, where he just did a commercial and used a Jackson Browne song, Running on Empty.
Right.
And he didn't get permission, right? So to Richard's point, there is a requirement to get a license, a master use if you're using the original sound recording, and then a license from the writers of the words and music. So one, we're seeing situations where some politicians are just kind of going off script here, and they're using music that has not been approved by the label or the writers. And that could include everything from a commercial. It could include music that's embedded in a social media post and those kind of issues. It's certainly what is now more complicated that Richard's touched on is these rallies. So at least the way it works in the U.S. is, if you're having a rally at a venue, then in their broadcasting music, they need a public performance license. And I guess if we think about this, so if you go to a sports game and they're playing music at a soccer match or a basketball game during halftime or wherever, they're allowed to do that via their broadcast license, via the performance rights organization. I think the step that a lot of politicians, namely Donald Trump, is skipping is specifically with ASCAP and BMI, and I guess I speak more of this to the US, is they do require, if a campaign is going to use this as a political message, that they go an extra step and get the songwriter's permission. And the songwriter, the copyright holder, can notify the PRO, BMI or ASCAP, that they don't want a specific campaign, or they don't want their music used in a campaign. So the issue that's coming up is, you know, for instance, Trump Organization is relying on kind of a blanket PRO license and saying, hey, we're doing a rally. It's at a gymnasium or an auditorium, and they have a performance license. So we don't need permission, and there you go. But I think if you dig into the PRO rules, there is a special license required. And basically, they make an exception to say, if the music is played at a convention or if it's broadcast on TV. So again, something like the RNC broadcast or the DNC broadcast, where they're playing this music and then that goes on to television, those do require a special license and not just working off of the blanket license. I think that's a lot of the issues that you're hearing about with a lot of musicians. And I guess a final kind of complicating factor I've noticed is some of these rallies, specifically that Donald Trump had, or as you know, they're just like makeshift setups, outdoors. It's not a venue. It's just, you know, like literally like a field and people are showing up, right? Well, I would suspect that in those instances, there's actually no performance license at all that's ever been secured, because there's not really a venue. They're like building these venues, you know, they build a stage and they just say, hey, come on. So I think that's also another kind of complicated wrinkle to this, where what happens when these political rallies are not at a venue that even has a performance license. So that does get you into a zone that I think the musicians can try to protect their music.
Wow, pop-up rallies. That really is like opening a whole can of worms right there. And of course, as you've both been saying, you know, you can have these songs being used at rallies, but then somebody's filming it and it goes onto social media and the, you know, political party puts it on social media. And, you know, the social media is a bit of a free-for-all, despite there being guidelines and requirements in place. I remember the Beastie Boys were less than pleased, I believe, when I think it was Nigel Farage or the Brexit Party or somebody like that used one of their tracks in the UK on a quote-unquote viral social media thing. So it's a bit of a Wild West, it seems. A lot of music clearance is very well established and regulated, but when it comes to politics, all bets are off, really. It's pretty fascinating. So I'd be curious to know, is there anything that you can speak of that you or your firm has worked on in terms of music clearance with any kind of contentious background or maybe even for political use?
Yes. So one of our key clients is a gambling client who works in both sports gambling and online gaming in the sense of bingo games. And that can be seen as quite contentious for some artists and songwriters, and we do get quite a lot of denials. The way we get around that is when clients are seeking to use certain music, we reach out to rights owners, so typically music publishers and record labels, and we ask them to pitch songs and recordings to us that they know they can clear for gambling ads. But of course, all of these ads are pieces of content that are pre-prepared. So it's absolutely required that synchronization licenses have to be in place prior to any use. And that would be the same for political campaign videos that are edited together in an edit suite and someone decides which track is going to be put against it. And that's a predetermined decision. In the live context that Dino was talking about earlier on, particularly for pop-up venues, it's a very different situation. And pop-up venues can have public performance licenses. We do this with one of our fashion clients. Sometimes they create fashion shows in a marquee, in a field, and with sufficient notice, you know, one can get public performance licenses from the performing right organizations in the UK. It's the PRS, and that provides for a blanket license for the use of music within that event. If a third party media organization comes along and films and broadcasts it in the same way that happens with political rallies, it is the responsibility of the broadcaster to have their own separate public performance license for their broadcast channel. Ooh. Now, one of the key differences between the UK, well, one of there are several differences between the UK and the US in this area, is that firstly, the UK only has one PRO for songs and compositions. So in the UK, we have the PRS. In the US, there's actually four. So ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and Global Music Rights, GMR. But also, the US does not have, and Dino, please correct me if I'm wrong here, does not have the same public performance right in sound recordings, which are often called neighboring rights, as Europe does.
That's correct.
So in the UK, we have PPL that licenses the public performance right in sound recordings for events or broadcasts, or radio broadcasts. But in the US, it doesn't exist in the same way. And Dino, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that for a political rally in an event space, let's say an auditorium, the owners of that auditorium need blanket licenses from ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and GMR, but there is no equivalent for the recordings.
Fascinating. My goodness. Like, the more that we are discovering about this whole area, the more complicated it's getting. I can see why people get quite upset when things don't quite go according to plan. There's so many rules and pockets of rules to know about. And as Dino used that marvelous word, so many wrinkles to kind of trip over. But Dino, coming over to yourself there, we heard from Richard about some of the areas that maybe could be viewed as contentious in terms of music clearance. But have you and your firm represented any folks who maybe were concerned about the usage of their music in certain situations, maybe even political situations?
Yeah, this comes up fairly often. I mean, by way of background, I think you mentioned at the beginning, I work with Mavis Staples and the Staples Singers. For a while, I represented the estate of Mahalia Jackson. So, you know, if it's a client that might be very religious, then deals with alcohol brands could be concerning. Deals with gambling organizations could be concerning. We have clients that are sober. They may not want to do an alcohol brand endorsement type deal. We've run into situations where maybe the performer or the writer may turn a blind eye or not approve of pornographic material, adult-oriented material. Those kind of licenses come in, and they may reject those. And then, you know, the hot topic we're talking about, just political endorsements. You know, we'll get requests for licenses for politicians for licensing, and maybe it's a candidate they don't support. So this is a classic situation, as that the money doesn't always win when it comes to these licenses. You know, the client might be analyzing, do I want to be attached to that brand, or does a client want to be endorsing, you know, a lifestyle or whatever? So, I mean, I think it's fairly common for entertainment lawyers or music licensing clearance experts to deal with this situation. And they have to be sensitive about what the writer or the band is thinking about those brands.
You know, you don't hear about all of the campaigns that people would say no to for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, obviously there's so much work that goes on behind the scenes with entertainment lawyers, with music clearance experts. There's a whole kind of backroom that's just purring away with activity 24/7 there. Now, let's talk about some campaigns that maybe have caught our eye, or things that we've liked in terms of a positive use of music in politics, or indeed the opposite of the use of music backfiring for a political candidate. I mean, it's somewhat of a moot point as to what difference it would make to the outcome of any particular election, perhaps, but it is kind of instructive to know where musicians and folks land and where they see their values aligning. So I'd like to just put an open question out to the both of you. Choose an example that you like of music use in politics, and an example that you thought backfired. And I don't know who'd like to jump in there first.
Okay, I've got a couple of examples. I mean, these are UK-centric examples. I think one of the examples that's talked about a lot was the use of D-Ream's Things Can Only Get Better in the campaign videos and rallies for New Labour in 1997. And I think that was held up as an example of where the artist and the songwriters were very aligned with the philosophy of the political party that wanted to use their music. And in that context, it's a win-win because the writers and artists are fine, you know, happy for this to go ahead. They're getting paid. There's no negative stories. And so everybody's happy. I think where, you know, we've talked about some of the uses of Trump and the music that he uses in his campaigns, and the opposite is true. In terms of a bad example, and this is perhaps one more where that reflects badly on the politician rather than the music, was the use of Dancing Queen by ABBA as Theresa May very badly danced onto the stage at the Conservative Conference in 2018. I mean, it is so cringeworthy. It's actually hilarious. And that was purely a rally use. So arguably, the only license that was required was the public performance licenses, which would have been from PRS and PPL. But of course, it was broadcast, and you can find it very easily on YouTube if you look. But yeah, I think a very ill-advised piece of theatre on behalf of the Conservative leader at the time.
Oh yeah, my goodness, I am cringing just remembering that dance routine, and it did not do her any favours whatsoever. That's a great example. And Dino, how about your good self?
Yeah, let me give you a couple that come to mind. I mean, in the US, music has been used with politicians. This goes back all the way to literally Thomas Jefferson. I mean, William Harrison in the 1840s used a tune, Tippy Canoe and Tyler Too, which became a hit. I guess a couple I can think of, one right here in Louisiana. This is, of course, very Louisiana story. We had a singing governor. His name was Jimmy Davis, and he wrote the song, You Are My Sunshine.
Amazing.
And that was in the 40s, and that was his campaign anthem. And basically, that song became, in my opinion, a worldwide hit, covered by all kind of jazz greats. Around that same era, you know, you have FDR. I think I mentioned this one, using In the Depression, Happy Days Are Here Again. And then kind of moving to the modern era, I mean, I think some successful uses, Bill Clinton's Don't Stop Believin'. That was a great campaign. Ross Perot kind of humorously tried to use Patsy Cline's Crazy. You know, so they've been some entertaining ones. Probably in terms of backfiring examples, I think, again, we could probably look to Donald Trump for quite a few good examples. I mean, no pun intended. He attempted to use You Can't Always Get What You Want, which created issues. And then the Stones ended up sending him a cease and desist letter. So he got what he wanted. He couldn't use the song. Another kind of amusing one I found was President Trump tried to use Rockin' in the Free World, the Neil Young song, and Neil Young fought him on that. And then Neil turned around and gave Tim Walz, the vice presidential candidate, permission to use that song at the DNC convention. So kind of an amusing turn of events there. But, you know, there's just a lot of other kind of Trump tried, you know, Eddie Grant, the White Stripes, Isaac Hayes. All these have been attempts, some of which have been litigated at this point. And Trump is tending to lose these cases.
Well, I guess he can pardon himself for all copyright infringement forever quite soon. That's going to be an interesting presidential decree, you know. The estate of Isaac Hayes must give me, who knows? Anyway, anyway, I'm not going to go there, but that's totally fascinating. My goodness. I'm curious to know, What's the route to work at this overlap between rights and music and, you know, sometimes even politics and contentious brands and all this kind of stuff? Like, is this something that you both always wanted to do? I mean, Richard, let's start with yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are.
Well, I got into music licensing through, as many people do in the music industry, sort of playing in bands. And in fact, I did a music degree, so I've got some sort of classical training. And I had a stint of writing music for commercials. Various friends of mine were sort of had come out of being in bands and thinking, well, you know, after so many years of not making any money, what can I do in music that might actually earn me a living? So I started writing music for commercials and got a bit of a taste of the way the advertising industry worked, and particularly the budgets that they had for the use of music, which were quite surprising. And I then managed to get myself into Zomba Music Publishers and set up their sync team. So handling the promotion and the licensing of songs within that publishing catalog. And I think that's when I first started to understand the whole issue around approval, and particularly for US writers, where often we would be presenting UK opportunities to the US office that would regularly get denied, often around the sums that were being paid, because fees paid in the UK were considerably lower than the US, but also because, you know, it might be that the writer didn't like the commercial we were pitching the song for, or the feature film we were trying to get a placement in. And so I began to understand it's not just a case of pitch a song or a recording into a sync placement. You've got to convince the people who have the right of approval that this is a good deal and that this is something that they might want to do. And I think this then speaks to some of the issues Dino was mentioning earlier in the political arena around the sort of implied endorsement, because if a track by an artist is used at a political rally, even if the only licenses that are actually needed are public performance, recognizing, as Dino said, that there are some, you know, potential additional approvals that are needed, the songwriter and the artist will perceive that as being an endorsement of some sort, and particularly worried that their fans will see it as an endorsement. And I think that's the area that particularly upsets and riles artists and writers who feel, you know, I do not want this politician who is diametrically opposed to me in values using my music. You know, it's wrong on every level. And I think this is why this area is A, so interesting, and B, so contentious.
Yeah, it's a vibrant area. I have a suspicion it's not going to get any less vibrant and contentious as we move forward.
No. Well, I think just as a final thought on that, and you kind of touched on this earlier on, Trump as a character is clearly someone who enjoys provoking his opponents and basically provoking anybody. And having looked into the sort of background ahead of this chat today, so many of the uses, even in campaign videos that have gone ahead without licenses, I don't believe for a minute that the Trump team didn't know they needed licenses. They just simply chose not to get them in an attitude of, well, you know, what are you going to do about it? You don't like it, so sue us. And I think once Trump gets back into office and given his appointments within the Supreme Court and his very sort of public comments about how he wants to make changes to the DOJ, I don't think it's unreasonable to think he will believe himself to be invincible and will do what he likes and will pardon himself the moment anything unpleasant happens.
Yeah, wow, there's a thought. We're going to have presidential endorsements on Kid Rock cover Sam and Dave, best of. You know, again, can open worms everywhere. That's it.
Well, the Supreme Court have, wasn't there a thing recently where they confirmed that the president, whilst in power, if performing an official act, was effectively immune from prosecution?
I know, my goodness, what's this going to do for music rights at political rallies? It's like all hell breaking loose. But listen, thank you, Richard. That's really, really fascinating. But Dino, I know you are a real music guy. We've hung out at South By in Austin, Texas. And, you know, you've been very much focused on, okay, we have to go here to catch William Bell because this is such a rare opportunity, or we got to go here and catch Snoop Dogg. I mean, you're a real music lover. How did you get into the whole legal side of music? Did you come from the music side first, or was it more from the legal side?
I mean, in junior high, I was in a fledgling band. My only claim to fame is some of the guys in the band later went on to get signed to Island Records. And later, I was lucky enough to represent that band. But I mean, it largely comes from, you know, a deep passion and love of music. I grew up in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is Cajun Creole country. So we've got Zydeco and Cajun music playing every weekend, which was amazing. And then I went to school at Tulane in New Orleans. It was the height of the Neville Brothers fame. The Radiators were kicking as well. So really, I kind of came from this culture where music is really important. And I've always loved music. And getting through law school and after graduating, I realized, at least in this region, there was a real kind of void in the market. If you were a successful band, you eventually had to get an entertainment lawyer involved, and largely your options were to hire someone in New York or LA. I thought to myself, like, no disrespect to New York and LA lawyers, they're great lawyers, but you know, they don't necessarily speak the same language. And I grew up with these people, and I thought, you know, I could probably carve out a boutique shop here representing composers, performers of music, and, you know, be a zealous advocate for them and protect their rights, do their deals. And one band begets another and word of mouth spreads, and, you know, slowly built a pretty solid book of business representing, you know, some of my idols. So it's been professionally very rewarding. I always say that any entertainment lawyer, I think, naively thinks to some degree that we are part of the building blocks of making a band successful. And I can look at bands where I'm thinking like, oh, wow, you know, it was really going to this South By and meeting this A&R person and then getting that A&R person to see my band. And then the band got signed. And then from there, you know, things just changed dramatically for the band. So I do feel like, as an entertainment lawyer, we are an essential kind of cog in the wheel here to get the band rolling and for their success to some degree. You know, obviously the talent has got to be there, and that's first and foremost. But yeah, I've always had that passion. And obviously the more I got involved in it, became a passion of protecting artists' rights, enforcing their rights, and negotiating their deals.
Yeah, for real. I mean, that makes a huge difference just to have somebody in your corner who knows the law, who's prepared to go to bat for you and knows the way to do it, but is a real music lover as well. I mean, that can be just transformational for a band with talent to have that kind of a connection and that kind of person on their side. But Dino, I'm curious, are you seeing in terms of, you know, because you read articles saying, you know, there's not many music deals out there or labels are not signing so many bands. I mean, what are you seeing from your viewpoint? Are your artists getting a lot of deals at the moment?
Yes, they are. I mean, I see that chatter, but the truth of the matter is the bulk, and by bulk, I mean over probably 75% of my clients, they're still in some version of a record deal. And they have a partner with a label, or it might be with a distributor. You know, publishing deals are still happening every day. You know, for me, obviously, it keeps the lights on around here. But I mean, now the market has expanded. You know, I mean, there's now lots of new and unique opportunities out there, whether it be, you know, the world that Richard's in of branding, endorsement, sponsorship has exploded. You've got people crushing it on TikTok, but I have these TikTok artists that they get penetration, and then guess what happens? I start getting the majors calling me, and guess next step is the major wants to sign the TikTok artist, you know? So things do change, but my client base still operate in some level of a partnership, whether it be a joint venture, a conventional record deal, a 360 deal. All those things are still happening, at least from my perspective.
Good, good. Happy to hear that. That seems like it's, despite the changes and the fast pace of technology, that deals are still happening, talent is still getting signed, they're using more platforms, but labels are still connecting with talent, helping them reach the world. So that's fantastic. I was hoping to hear something like that, Dino. Thank you. So listen, before I ask each of you a very important question that we ask all of our VIPs, which is to choose a track for our VIP Audio Talks title playlist, I am going to hit you with one final question. And this is to get out your crystal balls. I mean, in terms of music rights, in terms of clearance, in terms of politics, in terms of like everything, the whole shebang, where do we think this is going to go in the future? You know, do things like AI come into the mix at all? What kind of things are we going to be listening out for in future election cycles? And I'm going to come to yourself first, Richard.
Well, so much has been said about AI and its influence on music. I think, as we mentioned at the top of the discussion, the reason that politicians use well-known tracks is because they cut through. The recognizability is everything. That's what fires up the audience. And Dino, you know, spoke very eloquently about how the lyrics and the emotion in the music will engage and fire up the audience at a rally. And you cannot replicate that with an AI track that might sound similar to a well-known song. So I don't think that's going to happen. I think in terms of other things for the future, as we talked earlier on, I think under the new presidency, I anticipate there will be a lot more cease and desist letters flying around. Whether that leads to any successful prosecutions remains to be seen. I suspect not, but I, seeing how Trump behaves, I think he will feel that he has the license to effectively use whatever he likes, license in inverted commas, without actually having the real license to use whatever he likes.
Yeah, it could be a golden age for litigation. Let's wait and see.
Well, that's indeed, a indeed.
Great point, Richard. Thank you. And Dino, what say you? What things do you think our listeners should be thinking about when they think about the future of this whole area?
Well, when we talk about the future, of course, we have to look only to Taylor Swift.
Oh, yeah.
We can think about what's happened to Miss Swift, which was that Donald Trump posted a Taylor dressed up as Uncle Sam saying that she wanted you to vote for Donald Trump, right? So in this kind of situation, she's made a claim that this was a false and misleading social media post. It was AI generated. I mean, the issue here, and I think to echo Richard's thoughts, you're going to see a lot more of this. We're seeing more and more publicity statutes being passed in the U.S. Louisiana, matter of fact, just recently adopted one. So that prevents someone from using your name, image, and likeness for commercial gain. So I think you're going to see developments perhaps with publicity rights. In terms of Congress, with AI, there is a pending No Fakes Act, which basically is going to try to make it illegal to publish digital replicas of people. And that's kind of what's happened in this Taylor Swift situation. It was a digital replica of her, which is an implied endorsement, which also kind of triggers this U.S. act called the Lanham Act, which is kind of a trademark antitrust statute that basically says, you know, you can't use name, image, likeness for someone for an implied commercial endorsement in their music. So I think Richard's right. You're going to see lots and lots of more cease and desist letters, lawyers trying to figure out new angles in terms of legal strategy, especially in the world of social media and changes with technology there, and whether or not the law is kept up with the TikToks and whoever that are allowing the posting of this. And we could see, you know, the performance rights organization beef up and clarify their positions in terms of use of music at, you know, rallies. And I imagine some of that's going to undergo somewhat of an overhaul. So, yeah, I think it's going to be complicated as all things in the future, but we'll get through it.
Indeed, indeed. Well, it's reassuring to hear once again that it's Tay-Tay's world and we just live it. I could not agree with you more. That's brilliant. Okay, folks, we have one more question for each of you. And I know you're both music lovers, you know, music people, and it's an important question. And that is to choose a track for our VIP Audio Talks title playlist. And we'll start with yourself, Dino.
I'm going to go with a client. Lake Street Dive has a new record out. And they have a single called Good Together. They're actually going to be touring Europe in January and February. I would encourage all your listeners to go and check them out. They are an amazing band. I read in the New York Times recently, they said, the best band you've never heard of. So hopefully more people will hear them. It's a rock band, kind of a little bit cast in a jazz context with a stand-up bass player, an amazing singer that sounds like Amy Winehouse meets Sarah Vaughan or something. I love their new single, Good Together, and I thought it was kind of fitting for this podcast.
Hell yeah. Fantastic. My goodness. They're ticking so many of my favorite boxes already. I will be scouring their European tour dates to see if I can pop over and see them. Thank you, Dino. Brilliant. Brilliant choice for our playlist. And Richard, how about your good self? What track are you going to treat our listeners' ears to?
So, track I'm going to pick is called Surfer's Journal by a Canadian artist called Leif Vollebekk, who has a new album out called Revelation. I found out about this artist because a very good friend of mine called Chris Elliott was asked by Leif Vollebekk's team to arrange some strings on this new album, including this track. And Chris was saying, it's a really interesting artist because his songs don't really have sort of conventional verses and choruses in the way you're used to. And I started listening to him and just fell in love with him. And I was very lucky I had the chance to see him play at a venue called Chalk in Brighton, which is just down the coast from Worthing. And he was phenomenal. He was one of the best shows I've been to in many, many years. So I would very strongly recommend that the listeners check out Leif Vollebekk, the new album called Revelation, and particularly this track called Surfer's Journal.
Oh, fantastic. I love intriguing, fascinating music tips with a fascinating backstory. And that was absolutely brilliant. So I'm looking forward to diving in there. My own contribution to the playlist is going to be a bit on theme. And it is a track called Sex Farm by the great Spinal Tap, because they preemptively demanded that Donald Trump would not play Sex Farm at any of his campaign rallies. And I think their demands might just have worked. So listen, thank you so much for joining us on the Audio Talks podcast. Thank you, Dino Gankendorf.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And thanks so much, Richard Kirstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, this is the end of series number 10. Oh my goodness, we're going to be popping open a nice bottle of wine after this. Why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot, and it helps new listeners get to know about the righteous guests we speak to in every episode, like Richard and Dino. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more eagle-eyed Audio Talks. See you next time.